Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. Stay tuned tonight for our 23rd episode. We deconstruct the map with Dennis Wood. Stay tuned. Dennis Wood, rogue cartographer, radical geographer, or maybe just rogue, or as he self-described to me, a guy who is interested in the world. He first made waves in the field of geography with his eventual Book of the Month selection titled The Power of Maps. Considered radical at the time, it, along with other key texts by J. Brian Harley, opened up a critique of the modern cartographic enterprise. Wood is an artist, author, cartographer, and former professor at North Carolina State University, and still lives there in the state capital of Raleigh. The importance of his, to date, 30-year project is immeasurable, as it continues to inform and inspire the work of a whole generation of poets, activists, psychogeographers, and critical or new cartographers using various forms of mapping in their own practices. He asks the questions. What is a map? What is cartography? Well, he asked in a loud voice.
When I started studying cartography in graduate school, there was no question about what a map was, and there was no debate about it. Uh-huh. Maps were completely taken for granted. They were obvious things, and they were as old as human language, maybe even older than human language. So they were this ancient form of communication. That's what maps were when I started studying it. And they'd been around forever, and we knew exactly what they were. And our problem in cartography was to learn how to make them as perfectly as we could.
But for Wood, learning a craft just wasn't enough. He wanted to dig deeper. He wanted to critique the whole enterprise, to critique and perhaps rewrite the history of cartography, seeing its limitations through the Western worldview, the Western perspective.
That started this questioning about cartography.
Yeah.
And the questioning has become, you know, a mainstream component of the field, although, you know, I am still widely hated by many people in the cartographic community.
And what is it? Is it a warm story about the history of cartography that you're really trying to challenge? Is it about, you know, is Harley, for instance, a revisionist historian? Are you trying to write a revisionist history?
Oh, Harley is almost as bad as Wood.
So you want to rewrite the history of cartography?
No, I mean, we were terrible people throwing questions at them that they couldn't answer, that they'd never had to answer,
right?
Because they'd taken it all for granted. You know, they'd just taken it for granted.
This is the wallpaper on grandmother's kitchen that no one wants to question, no one can even describe if they want to. This idea that cartography is just a form of communication. This is one you don't like, right? Is that the map is a representation, right?
The map is an accurate representation of the world.
Right.
You know, that is so much claptrap. It's just not true in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
And it's taken a long time to to get my eyes completely open to see around all these things that, you know, you'd take them in with your mother's milk.
I want to read something. It's from a paper or a chapter that you wrote about the anthropology of cartography. And it talks about sort of a, maybe it wasn't a post-it, but today maybe we would have a post-it that you put on your computer to to remind yourself, it says, to get away from this idea that it's map is a representation. And this is what you said. A map is more or less permanent, more or less graphic objects supporting the descriptive function in human discourse that links things through territory by fusing onto a common plane, that of a map, multicoded images of the very world the map itself brings into being. Due to this, maps become weapons in the fight for social dominion, weapons disguised as representations of the world. So
yeah, I typed that out in all caps and had it hanging on the wall directly in front of my typewriter. We didn't have computers in those days. Yeah, and it was so that I could continuously keep in mind what it was that I thought a map was through the haze, the long, long, deeply imbued haze of representationalism.
Right.
It was just, you know, it was a necessary thing to do, and it took a long time to get the map as representation out of my mind because it was so deep in there.
Right. I mean, because it is a deeply embedded, culturally embedded sort of idea that the map is this representation, that it is, again, I come back to this idea that it's neutral, that it's not, like you say in the last phrase there, a weapon disguised as a representation of the world. That's a different way of thinking about it. I mean, do you think,
yeah,
is that a, you know, here the show, we call it the geographical imagination. Is the change in the definition here, that long process, and you're saying it took you a long time to kind of get away from that. Is that expanding, at the very least, that cartographic imagination or the geographical imagination as well? Is that shift?
Well, it's expanded in lots of places and lots of areas.
Yeah.
Certainly, it's almost taken for granted in geography these days.
Because it's become so, we're all reading this and for the listener too, like the work that you and Brian Harley did 30 years ago is now, what do we call it? Critical cartography, right? I mean, those are the key first.
That's what they call it, yeah.
The key first texts. Of it doesn't sound like you like that name, but those are the key first texts.
I mean, you know, you stop caring after a while what they call it. They have to put it in a box someplace.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. So we're back with Dennis Wood, and I know maybe you don't like so much the category of critical cartography and maybe academia trying to categorize and label things. Is it a movement? I mean, is it a shift?
Well, first of all, I think the problem with it isn't just that they want to label it and categorize it. They want to isolate it. That's what they want to do. You know, critical cartography is clearly not cartography because cartography doesn't require a modifier. So critical cartography is clearly some marginal activity carried out by marginal human beings.
So it's like alternative histories.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Like as soon as you say alternative, that it just sounds, it doesn't sound as official, right? I mean, it sounds marginalized, like you're saying.
It's marginalized, and it's not that it's, there is no official, I mean, I was going to say there is no official cartography, but that's not true. There are all kinds of official cartography. People are constantly designating themselves as guardians of the flame and, laying down international accords and national accords and so forth, all of which is nonsense, because anybody can make a map, and most maps that have ever been made have not been made by cartographers. Today, they're not made by cartographers.
So is that part of the critical cartography? I don't want to call it a movement. I think that might suggest other things too. But this embracing of critical cartography, is that opening up who makes maps and what kind of maps are made? Is that part of it?
No. What happened, of course, is really kind of simple and straightforward, and it's sort of like the coming into being of cartography, in fact. There are innovations and little collections of people, and something explodes. And in this case, it was GIS, which in the beginning was Geographic Information Systems.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a way of thinking about geography using a computer. That's what it started as. And it became, of course, Geographic Information Science. And in the early 90s, it became a big deal. And it gradually pushed cartography as a field out of the game. So geography departments that had cartographers on their faculty who were retiring or dying, they were not being replaced by people who called themselves cartographers. They were being replaced by GIS specialists,
right?
People who knew about GIS and could use GIS to, among other things, make maps. So at the very heart of the transformation was the rise of GIS. The second thing was the rise of the internet.
Right.
And internet mapping and computer mapping. As these things spread and became more popular, it became possible for people of every walk of life to think about making maps. They saw them on the internet, and they made them and put them on the internet. So all kinds of people began making maps, you know, quite independently of cartography or GIS or geography or anything else. They were making maps as their birthright, which it is. People have always been able to make maps.
Whether it's in the sand or on a napkin or a scrap piece of paper.
Metaphors that we love to use. In the sand or the snow or
right.
Drawn in the air with the flight of the hand. You know, yeah, exactly. So they've always been able to make maps, and that's what they started to do in abundance. And publish them online. You know, suddenly there is this incredible forest of maps. And it prompted me to write my editorial for Cartographica. Cartography is dead, parents. Thank God, closed parents.
Right.
Because it was really, in some profound sense, the beginning of the end of cartography, which had been created in the first third of the 19th century and had run its course, parallel to, you know, the great map-making enterprises of Rand McNally's railroad atlases,
uh-huh.
Railroad maps.
Right.
You know, these things, they didn't have cartographers. the thought is really kind of funny. And, you know, the original state highway maps were not made by cartographers. The road maps weren't made by cartographers. And all of these things were flourishing publishing activities in the United States that, you know, gradually became touched by cartography after cartography became an established discipline in American and Western European universities.
And so in those universities, then you have the person going through one of those programs is learning these sort of official skills of the cartographer. And then that whole program becomes formalized, it's specialized knowledge. And then what you're talking about is like GIS comes in the 80s and then in the 90s even more so, along with the internet, people's access to, some people like to say the democratization of cartography, or at least of the access to the tools. So I could sit at my computer and design a map, whereas perhaps earlier you really needed either specialized software or supposedly you needed a specialized set of skills to do so.
Or you needed a pen and a piece of paper. You know, most of my maps start out with pen and paper, and they always have. When I got to graduate school and discovered geosophy,
right.
I thought, well, clearly, anybody can make a map from a Hottentot to a queen.
Uh-huh.
Why not me? And I started thinking about Cleveland Heights, where I had grown up as a teenager.
Right.
And I started drawing maps of them, you know, on pieces of paper, scratch paper, the weirdest pieces of paper, and, you know, trying to come to terms with how I came to know Cleveland Heights as a thing. And I haven't, I didn't publish them until until fairly recently.
All right.
When so, they became, you know, hot items. Yeah. There's a British publisher that came out with this incredible collection of map pieces. Where You Are, I think it's called.
Yeah.
You Are Here.
You Are Here, right.
You Are Here.
Uh-huh.
And there's 16 little, it's a box, and it has 16 individual booklets in it. And each one of the authors is responsible for one of those booklets. And I, mine was about my paper route. And those were, that was an opportunity in which I was able to publish some of those maps that I'd drawn in 1967 when I started graduate school on scrap paper.
So, so this
or
is,
notebook paper and stuff.
So so this is the idea of geosophy. I mean, how would we kind of pin that down a little bit? And it's kind of
it's the geographic knowledge of all people.
Of all people.
Or so, any person.
So we all have geographical knowledge or geographic knowledge. I have here a subtitle of an article you wrote, The Fine Line Between Mapping and Map Making. And you said that one of the subheadings, I guess we could call it, is every adult has the spatial competence to make a map, but only certain societies encourage its expression.
Yeah.
So what's, yeah, what are we...
What are we talking about there?
Yeah. I mean,
well,
in terms of geosophy...
Well, what do you need a map
and,
for God's sake? Who needs a map?
So the expression that... So which societies are going to encourage its expression? The ones that are doing cartography or the ones...
No, not cartography. The ones that are utilizing and promoting map use. For example, Google Maps has made more impact on the map world than anything ever, ever.
Right.
You know, because people around the world now can open their phone and go to Google Maps and look at their where they live in this map form. That was never possible before, and people didn't use maps. They had other forms of expression. Somebody would want to know, so how do I get to that restaurant? You say, well, you go down here and you turn right on such and such a street, and then you turn left there, and it's, you know, a third of a mile down there. And that's how you told people where to go. You didn't draw them a map, and you certainly didn't click on the show me button on the website and get a map pop-up from Google Maps or Open Street or whatever.
Right, right. So
now anybody can do it. Everybody does it. Everybody uses maps all the time. And you know what? They can't remember when they couldn't do that.
Hmm.
And so, you know, it's just this just increasingly enforces the idea that we really, really need maps. Whereas at the beginning of the 20th century, very, very, very few people used maps, and they were all in advanced societies with, well, that's not true either, but they were mostly in advanced societies with printing technologies and trains and schedules and clocks and calendars and the whole rigmarole.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Geographical Imaginations is an hour-long radio essay program broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. This public geography project presents a geographical or spatial way of thinking about our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. Each episode takes a theme, or perhaps a question, and explores it through an interactive dialogue with different texts and voices. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. I mean, how important is the map in kind of shaping then our initial imaginations about the world out there? I picture someone, the school, the student, looking at an atlas and getting their first impressions about a world, you know, the world out there, the place they have not been to, by kind of trying to enter into the map and looking at the map. I mean, is this still...
That's the way they do it in Dr. Doolittle. You know, Tommy Stubbins journeys through Dr. Doolittle's atlas, and he runs his fingers along the routes of the rivers. And Marlowe, in the Conrad novel, he does the same thing. And I think it's a literary device that is used to make a suggestion that would answer your question. Yeah. I don't know that that's how it happens. I don't know that that's how it happens at all. I don't know what maps mean to little kids.
Yeah.
They mean things, but I don't think they mean the same things that we think about when we think about using a map to explore the world. The world is explored gradually as an increasing exposure in every sensory dimension to the world outside of us. Foreign food, posters, travel posters, the whole idea of travel and vacation.
Right.
And then the schooling. You know, there is a world. We are told that. We are told that quite young. There is a world, and it is spherical. A lot of people don't know that there's flat Earth society. They think,
where are they based?
They automatically think the world is round because they've been told it since they were little kids.
Right.
And our nation is the most wonderful nation in the world, and they learn about it as a way to build patriotism,
mm-hmm.
and they learn about their state and their city, and they're all devices that are involved in creating the child into a political being who has political allegiances to, you know, various levels of government.
Right.
Government needs, people as citizens that want to support the government. They don't need people that don't want to do that. And if you're going to support it, you know, you have to know what it is. You have to have some idea what North Carolina is. You have to know that if you're going to be involved in North Carolina things. And you have to know what Wake County is if you're going to be involved in Wake County things.
Right.
And you need to know what Raleigh is if you're going to be involved in Raleigh things. And, you know, drops down to neighborhood levels, finally. If you're going to have some kind of attachment to those far beyond anybody's ability to grasp aerial units, you have to have some way of holding that thing in your hand, and the map is a great way of doing that.
Right. I can remember at studying at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and going to a basketball game, which in itself is, I think, part of the Tar Heel Nation building, but the center of the basketball floor, it doesn't say UNC, it doesn't say North Carolina, it has the shape of the state of North Carolina. I always thought that was kind of interesting, like that this is so recognizable, right? The shape that we would normally see on a map, and here's this visual that's just being
It's an emblem. And it's on everybody's shirt. If you work for the government, it's on your shirt. It's on your truck. It's on your car. You know, it's on your stationery. It's everywhere. And it's constantly being reinforced,
Right.
And this is true of every shape. It doesn't have to be the shape of North Carolina. It can be the shape of Ohio.
Of course,
you know,
right.
Or the
of
shape
other states.
Of Israel.
Right. But the shape that we see on the map then sort of becoming, I mean, is it... We're using it in ways to reinforce that, to reinforce the idea, you know, Benedict Anderson said that the imagined community. Is this reinforcing that idea that you and I are both a part of this shape of North Carolina? We are North Carolinians. We are, I don't know, that means something, that there's a sense of belonging and maybe participation. I guess that's where we could get into.
Yeah, well, they want it to be participation, that's for sure.
Or consumption of ideas.
And it will be participation if you vote in an election, you know.
Right. To go back to
This has all been really, really well theorized by Thongchai Winichukul, who came up with the term geobody. And the geobody is precisely that thing, the embodiment of the nation in a form.
Like a symbolic form.
In a form that can be then plastered on stuff and venerated and worshipped and so forth and so on. Not that anybody would worship the state of North Carolina, but...
In his example, he's talking about, is it Thailand?
Thailand was his, it was his case study, yeah.
Yeah, and so what was being embodied? Like literally the shape of Thailand or in a different way this geobody played out?
Well, yeah, it was the shape of Thailand, but it was the shape of Thailand as distinguished from the shape surrounding it. So it was going to be different from Burma, and it was going to be different from French Indochina. And that difference was going to be embodied in that form. And, you know, the same thing's true of the United States. I mean, the United States comes into being in the late 18th century as a collection of extremely disparate former colonies.
Yeah.
And they don't know what they've become when they've become a nation. You know, they really have no idea. And one of the things that really, really helped clarify that for people was the promulgation of maps of the 13 colonies. You could see them. And being able to see them, you could put them on your wall, and you could frame them if it was a lovely map. And in any event, there it was. It had a body. It had something you could identify with. It wasn't some abstract idea, in geopolitical space. No, it wasn't anything like that. It was an actual thing you could see, and you could run your finger along the border and run it down the middle of these places, and you could say, oh, this is the United States. And as the United States grew, it continuously changed its shape and continuously promulgated the image of the latest version of the United States. It was a really important technique used by Americans.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. To find out more about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. To give some feedback or suggestion for a future episode, go to the comments section on the website, or go to the blog and enter into the conversation. Students seeing maps and seeing these shapes, you're talking about they should see Wake County, they should see North Carolina, these things mean something to them. What if do governments want students to know how to make a map? And what if, in all your practices, in all your experience in making maps, isn't there something we really learn by making them? And if the learning is actually being able to just know what goes into making a map, it allows you to sort of deconstruct the map, as which is kind of the theme that we've been talking about here a little bit. Is that a valuable
thing to do? Yeah, so they're asked to trace maps, you know. They're asked to do map exercises. They're asked to work with maps. They go out to the state fair, teachers do, and they get endless quantities of the state highway map, which they bring back to their classrooms and use in their classrooms.
Yeah.
And, you know, again and again, there's a map exercise. There's learning the names of the 100 counties. I don't know if they do that in school anymore. Mm. I had to learn the names of the counties of Ohio when
there's
I was
a lot
growing
there.
Up in Cleveland.
Yeah.
There are not 100 of them, but it's a large number.
Uh-huh.
And even today, I've been in... You know, I don't know how many I've been in, but it's not been a lot. And most of the ones that I've been in has just been driving through on an interstate. So, you know, barely any acquaintance at all. North Carolina is 100, and there was a time when you had to learn all 100.
Right.
The names are engraved in the surround of a fountain down in front of the North Carolina History Museum, and you can walk down and you can find your state name, and I don't know what you do with that when you find it. That's not the point. The point is,
but you reinforce
these
that
spatial geographic entities, these geobodies, are continuously thrown in our face. Continuously.
But we're not creating our own in the sense of we don't ask students in geography classes to go out and map the shadows in their neighborhood. And you know what I'm getting at here. I'm getting at a project.
No, of course they don't.
A project that you spent many years on in, what is it? What's the name of your neighborhood? Boylston Heights? Is that?
Boylan Heights.
Boylan Heights, sorry. Yeah. Mixing Boston and Raleigh there. Boylan Heights, you brought university students out, if I'm, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but in design classes to go out and learn how to sort of interact with space and understand
okay.
space and then design
so these
it?
These were landscape architecture students
okay,
to begin
yeah.
with.
All right, yeah.
Okay, so these are people who, when they graduate, are going to look for jobs or go on to graduate school in uh-huh. landscape architecture.
Right.
And that is to say they're going to intervene in the landscape and put a parking lot down or a park or a garden or something like that. Or they're going to site a building or they're going to site a home. And so they need to have some way of grappling with the geographic environment.
Uh-huh.
And more desperate than that, I was given a class of these students, and I knew nothing about landscape architecture, and what I knew was geography, and it occurred to me that, you know, I could ask them to go out and map these environments in these interesting ways and wake them up to the sorts of things I wanted landscape architects to be awake to. I wanted them to be awake to the lay of the land and the way the wind blew as a consequence of that and the way the shadows moved and so forth. I wanted them to be aware of these things. You know, there are formal, in site planning, you have to be aware of shadows. I don't know how
sure.
long that's been, you know, a truth in landscape architecture, but it's been a long while. So these were all things they needed to have some acquaintance with. You know, I wasn't asking them to map anything that was something that they might not need to know or pay attention to in their practice as professionals.
So you're shifting their vision. Or, I mean, you're asking them, I mean, it's easy to say to look at the sort of the more poetic way of looking at the place, but you're shifting their vision from those standard mapped things, those standard
I'm
mapped
shifting their
features.
Vision from the streets to the environment.
Okay, to get beyond seeing that place for just its streets, its infrastructure.
And this was in a day before Google Maps, you know. I mean,
right.
basically the way people think about mapping places most commonly is in terms of moving through it in automobiles or buses or some other way.
Hmm.
But it's about streets. It's about the public access way that we have to move through the environment. In English, the equivalent of the topographic survey sheets, the Ordnance Survey, you know, they map all those access ways. And many of them are for pedestrians. You know, paths through fields and
oh, right, right.
woods and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
They're all mapped.
What was the result of all that work? I mean, I know you've compiled quite a bit of the maps of Boylan Heights, and what do you think students got from it? I mean, what do they take from that? And I ask this more
well,
as a practical
question.
Well,
they took a lot from it. They took a lot from it. And we
yeah.
didn't just map Boylan Heights. In the beginning, we mapped local neighborhoods that you could get to very, very close to the North Carolina State University campus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Cameron Park and what's another one right over there? Oh, the neighborhood, I don't know what they call it these days. What is now today the Glenwood South area.
Uh-huh.
So we mapped local areas that you could get to because I didn't want them spending a lot of time, you know, driving someplace.
Right.
But that's what we were mapping, and they were producing, and they were doing two things. One, they were going out and seeing the environment with focused attention on things that they usually weren't focused on.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, they were producing innovative representations of those visions. They weren't representations of the landscape, but they were representations of those visions, or they embodied those visions in some way. So, for example, I remember one studio or one assignment in a studio where they had to make their map out of food. You know, so you know, it's about increasing their use of their imagination and spreading that out, and it's also about coming to know the environment in ways that they had not been habituated to before. That's what it was about, and it was very effective.
Hmm. I mean, is this, where do you put this in relation to, say, psychogeography?
I mean, whatever in the hell psychogeography is, you know, if I think about it as David Stay was teaching us about it originally, you know, and obligating us to read Kevin Lynch, it's all about that, because Kevin Lynch was about mapping the environment in as many ways as he could think about as well. And that doesn't all show up in Image of the City, but in Image of the City, there's the case study that's one of the appendices. And, you know, he's got people mapping brass doorknobs and people mapping railings and, you know, things that people don't ordinarily map. He's trying to understand what the elements are that conspire to create the image of an environment, of a neighborhood.
Yeah.
And you're mapping, you know, all the things that contribute to that, and you don't know what's contributing to that, so you map everything you can think of.
And it really, in the end, sort of revealing how complex that the image, in this case, the image of the city, or in perhaps the case of your studio, the image of that neighborhood or that street, by seeing how, you know, the multitude of things or movements that go into creating that. I mean, is that...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so what it was in the beginning was really, you know, a pedagogic exercise to get them to see and hear and feel, et cetera, more clearly, and to express themselves with, you know, greater facility.
Do you continue? Do you do things like this? Do you do workshops? I mean, do you bring people out and...
No. God forbid. That's ancient history.
Yeah.
Other people do, though. Other people who are inspired by that work do precisely that.
Yeah.
And they do them all over the place. You know, it's not something that's just, you know, local.
Right.
It's something that's now practiced around the world.
In the sense of what, going out into the city and doing similar
things
to like Lynch?
Seeing it and expressing it. And seeing it and expressing it in this particular case, map form, because the inspiration is a bunch of maps of an environment that show the environment in ways that people generally don't think about mapping places.
And is it generally so
exciting?
It's very exciting. But does their mind change about the map, or does their mind change about the place, or both?
Well, I assume it has to be both. I mean, there they are moving through the environment and noticing things in a systematic, structured kind of way. How can they think about the place the same way they did before they did that?
Right. I mean, the excitement is, oh, a map could be this. Isn't that sort of maybe the initial excitement? Oh, a map doesn't...
Well, that's another excitement. No, I think the initial thing was what to do with these students for a semester. I mean, that's the initial thing. The initial thing is how to fill their time in a fashion that will not get me fired. I mean, that's what it really boils down to. You know, these are landscape architecture students, and they do need to understand and appreciate the land in a rich way, and this is a good way to facilitate that.
Right.
that's what it's about, you know. And clearly they're going to think about the environment in a different way afterwards. Now, they might be brutalized by their job, you know, where they do nothing but site plans for parking lots. But that's going to kill them generally. It's not just going to kill their appreciation for the landscape.
So, yeah.
And boy, does it.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. What's so everyone's getting used to using Google Maps, and as we get used to those, do we lose contact with other kinds of maps and other ways of thinking about maps? For instance, something like deep mapping, which, as you know, the sort of the humanities and academia has embraced this as not always being, you know, concretely like a physical map, but it means other things, perhaps.
It sometimes isn't a map at all, as a matter
right.
of fact.
But limiting our, coming back to that idea of the cartographic imagination, if cartography and the map gets dominated by the so-called the Google map, do we lose sight of these other sort of mapping practices?
No, like, because those other sorts of mapping practices come along in a huge wave that follows the, you know, that front wave of the tsunami that is Google. Right behind them come, you know, the wide awareness and the ever-growing awareness of all of the other, you know, mapping agencies and mapping powers and mapping potentialities.
Yeah.
No, in fact, I think the opposite happens.
Okay.
It just explodes mapping in general.
Right. So we're not by relying on and really enjoying but relying on Google Maps, it's not going to limit then that imagination. So the poets, the psychogeographers, the activists, the artists, and maybe we could say the critical cartographers, they're still doing their work. They're still
can see through Google Maps. They can see it's an empty, vacuous bunch of streets.
Right.
And that's all it is. And what kind of a map is that? You know, I mean, they can see that. That jumps off the map page with incredible clarity. And then they can also see that a few places are marked on it, like, you know, Roy's Pizzeria. But by and large, the map is empty of anything but street names and the spaces that intervene between streets. So they can see that. That's perfectly clear. It's not necessarily clear to everybody else, but it's perfectly clear to people with any kind of imagination
right.
that this is an impoverished, mind-bogglingly impoverished map form.
Right.
Despite the magic of Street View and, you know, so forth and so on.
Right. So is it, I guess to come back to that idea, the deep mapping or maybe someone might call it the poetics of space or place, how does someone sort of, if the map is shaping the way someone thinks about place, what kinds of different mapping practices could someone engage in? I think of this maybe more. I'm thinking of this as a suggestion to someone. So maybe someone, the uninitiated, if they're to go out and map their place, the place they live. I mean, immediately people are going to think of. Sort of, some people will think of that Google Map form, but what are other ways I think someone could engage with the place in which they live?
Well, why do they want to map it? I mean, the answer to that question has to be in the motivation that pushes them to map it. And if they want to think about their place, have you read Prairie Earth?
Sure. Oh, yeah. William Least Heat Moon and Prairie
yeah.
Earth.
And yeah. you've read it.
Sure.
So it's what, 680 pages or 720 pages?
Uh-huh, Chase County,
and it's got
Kansas.
Those grossly impoverished little maps I think, I don't know how, where those maps came from. My feeling is maybe they were added by the publisher, because they are not maps of Prairie Earth. Prairie Earth is this massive prose. And right. What he wanted to tell was a story in prose. I mean, that's how he was describing that place. It was in prose, and prose worked perfectly for him. Well, he was a prose master, and it came natural to him, one might say. Maps didn't.
Yeah.
So you know, there are plenty of motivations for people to describe their place, where they live, and to make art and science out of it without involving maps at all. Why do you want to make a map? What is it about the map that calls you to present whatever it is in that particular form? And the answer to that question will give you the motivation with respect to their mapping someplace.
Right. Do you have any sort of, do you have any examples of, I wrote down here in my notes, great maps, but that might just be an awful adjective, but maps that maybe shifted your thinking about mapping and map making, the whole enterprise, that,
yeah,
are there the, maps that the really maps, shifted you?
They're the maps in Winnie the Pooh, and they're the maps in The Hobbit.
Maps in Winnie the Pooh, and what age? I mean, are we talking about later in life that you saw those?
That's where I remember. You know, it's a complicated issue, but I certainly encountered the expressive world in picture books as a kid.
Uh-huh.
As a little kid. And I've written about this I don't remember what it was. It was an introduction to a pair of special issues of the Cartographic Journal, or the Journal of Cartography, and NANO, North American Notes Online. And they were doing this thing together. And I'm not sure what that thing was, but it involved me reading or looking at 9 projects of strange mapping activities. And I introduced this article by talking about a map that's really a picture in Katie and the Snowplow, which is a book I read when I was, you know, I don't know how old I was. It was probably before I started school.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Katie is a tractor, and she runs around and does these wonderful things for, I forget the name of the city, Neapolis, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the snow comes and it buries everything. And so the city is now white. And she has to plow all the roads. And as she plows all the roads, you can see the creation of what becomes the map of this environment, of the city.
Like the city grid.
And she draws it with a snow plow. Now, you know, this was a radical idea for me. Not drawing with a snowplow, although that's a pretty radical idea too. But you know, making a map of a city, that was a radical idea. And there it was in that kid's book by Virginia Lee Burton, a great writer, truly great writer.
And so that's one of those first ones. That's one of those first maps that really sort of caught you and grabbed your attention.
Yeah. And then Winnie the Pooh. And I was in elementary school when I read Winnie the Pooh. And, you know, it's got that map of the 100-acre wood. Mm-hmm. And there's a map of the 100-acre wood. And then Dr. Doolittle, because he doesn't have maps. But then...
you said The Hobbit, was it?
J.R.R. Tolkien, yeah. The Hobbit, which I found in my grandfather's attic. And it was... you know, the first American edition, so it had all the color plates and everything, and it got the map in the front pages and the back pages, 2 different maps,
mm-hmm.
2 different scales. That was a revelation as well.
Huh. To see the world.
And you know, I could follow the story on those maps.
Did you need the... I have to admit, I haven't read it, but do you need the maps to really follow the story? I mean, do you have to go back?
No, of course not.
But you liked it.
And then a year later, I mean, I was 9 when the Lord of the Rings came out, or the Fellowship of the Rings, I should say, was the first volume. And it had the most wonderful map in the world, a fold-out map. Oh, my God. That was the most astonishing thing, a fold-out map of Middle-earth. Now, these were very, very powerful graphics that mobilized my imagination in ways that I continue to appreciate today.
Right.
They're really kind of remarkable. And it also shows the extent to which the map-making impulse had, you know, sedimented itself in the most bizarre places. I mean, there it is in, you know, a fantasy about hobbits who are fantasy people running around in a fantasy land called Middle-earth.
Right.
It's hilarious, you know. I mean, but no, those maps were really, really powerful goads to my mapping imagination.
So I want to continue there with what Dennis is talking about, this idea of the mapping imagination. He also mentioned the mapping impulse in tonight's episode. I want to encourage people to consider and deconstruct their own maps, their own Winnie the Pooh maps, the ones that have influenced them throughout their lives. And maps here, I mean very broadly. I'm talking in that broad sense of all those images that have informed the way we think of other spaces on the other side of the globe, on the other side of the city, on the other side of the street. And so how has that imagination been formed? How has that storehouse of images been collected? And so deconstructing our own sort of geographical imagination, our own map. But at the same time, I think going out and trying mapping and actually unpacking a little bit and demystifying the mapping process and going out and making maps, actually, of the places in which we live. I want to thank Dennis, who came to us from Raleigh. Also thank Mike Allen, who's been generous with his music. His song, Driffield Beats, is always accompanying us on the show. We've been in contact, actually, with him. He's in the UK studying for his PhD in sociology. So thanks to Mike for kind of accompanying us along this journey that we're on in discovering and thinking about our geographical imaginations. We'll look forward to our next episode, the end of our second season. And, until then, looking forward to meeting you again down the road. See ya. Bye.